Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. U.S. officials are contacting relatives of the crew members of the USS Fitzgerald, who died after their warship collided with a massive merchant vessel off the coast of Japan. Most sailors were asleep in compartments below the water's surface when the collision caused water to rush into their ship. Vice Admiral Joseph Akwan.
So we owe it to our families and the Navy to understand what happened. Under my authority, we will launch a JAGMAN investigation into this collision. I will appoint a flag officer to lead that investigation, and there will also be a safety investigation.
None of the 20-member crew of the Philippine flag container ship was reported injured. U.S.-backed Iraqi troops pushed into the last Islamic State stronghold in Mosul on Sunday, launching the final major battle of an 8-month campaign. Iraq has driven the militants from all but a handful of neighborhoods. The extremists are expected to make their last stand in the old city. VOA's Heather Murdoch in Iraq says many residents are moving for their own safety.
Since the beginning, there's been over 800,000 people who've left their homes. A lot of people have been going back from camps to homes, but the humanitarian crisis is ongoing outside of the city. I mean, there's just not the resources to take care of all of the people that are displaced at the moment. I mean, there are tents for people to be in, but it's 105 degrees at least almost every single day. That's 40 degrees Celsius around. And people are living in the desert in tents without enough food, without enough water.
VOA's Heather Murdoch. Portugal began observing 3 days of national mourning Sunday in honor of those killed in a massive forest fire. That story continuing. This is VOA News. At least 62 people killed, with dozens more reported to have been injured in that fire in central Portugal. The fire erupted amid an intense heat wave and rainless thunderstorm. This eyewitness said it was a very fast-moving fire. She said the wind was blowing very hard, and some say there was a kind of tornado that burned villages. Officials say hundreds of firefighters have been dispatched to battle the blaze in a mountainous area about 150 kilometers northeast of Lisbon. Spain and France are sending aircraft to assist in efforts to put out the flames. The European Union is also mounting an emergency assistance program. French voters are casting their ballots today in the final round of parliamentary elections. Political analysts say voters are likely to hand France's new centrist president, Emmanuel Macron, and his Republic on the Move party a resounding victory, likely winning more than 400 seats in the 577-seat National Assembly. This would enable Macron to push through his promised reforms of France's strict labor laws and its ailing social security system. The United States supports a 48-hour ceasefire declared by the Syrian army in southern Syria, but says it will wait to see what happens before judging its effectiveness. The announcement of the ceasefire comes as the United Nations says it wants to start a new round of peace talks next month in Geneva between all sides in Syria. United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, says the refugee and internally displaced people situation in South Sudan needs to be addressed urgently. According to the High Commissioner, around 1.9 million displaced people are in need of assistance. Grandi spoke with reporters.
The flight of people is a clear testimony that you're not taking enough responsibility for your own citizens. Because otherwise people wouldn't go away if they were not afraid, especially go away beyond borders to uncertain exile. So this is really a strong message to the leadership.
Grandi will head next to the Uganda Solidarity Summit on Refugees, where he will appeal for more aid for the South Sudanese. London police are saying at least 58 people were probably killed in the fire, a figure that includes 30 of those who have already been confirmed dead. Survivors of the high-rise apartment building fire claim the blaze was due to a lack of maintenance to that tower. For details on much more news, as always, we invite you to join us at our website. That is voanews.com. From here in Washington, I'm Michael Brown reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
I'm the one who went into the barracks to help the facilities and the commander and his two deputies to arrange a meeting for the prime minister.
The newly installed prime minister of the Kingdom of Lesotho meets the head of the army.
We conduct the poll, which we do every 6 to 8 weeks across the country. And this time around, we were asking about approval rating of the various leaders at their level of government.
The popular Tanzanian President John Magufuli sees his approval rating drop.
We are contemplating taking the matter to court so that those MPs bounce back in parliament. The decision was excessive, and we think that it was politically motivated.
And the Zambian main opposition party plans to take legal action over suspension of its lawmakers in parliament. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Prime Minister of the Kingdom of Lesotho, Tom Tabani, has met with the commander of the country's defense force, Lieutenant General Kwantle Motsamoto. Officials say the meeting was aimed to help resolve concerns the Prime Minister expressed about his personal security detail from the army. On two previous occasions, the Prime Minister fled the country after accusing the army of plotting to assassinate him. For more about the meeting between the Prime Minister and the head of the army, I reached Somonyani Ntsekeli, General Secretary of the ruling All Basotho Convention, who arranged the meeting.
Before his inauguration, he called the meeting for him and the commander of Lesotho Defense Force. And I can confirm, because I was a messenger in all these activities. I'm the one who went into the barracks to have the first meeting with the commander and his two deputies to arrange a meeting for the prime minister, of which they met and they agreed of the way forward of working together.
What about the issue of security? Because I understand Dr. Tabani, the new prime minister, has his own security. What is going to be different? Give me a brief description.
Even though there was arrangement of his private security, when he got into this thing of actually having to face the fact, he couldn't be guarded completely by his private security while he's at the same time a prime minister. That in our history, that has never happened. So that is why I'm saying he arranged for a meeting where they agreed. On the way forward, they agreed that during the inauguration, he will be handed over to the security of the army. So he came at the sort of stadium where the occasion was held. Then his private security handed him over to the national security, which is that one of the army. And as we speak now, the security around him is that of the army, even though he has a temporary arrangement whereby he has kept just one person who is his security. His previous security, I think the army agreed with him to keep him for a while. It is just a temporary measure. It is not something which is continuous.
The prime minister has had problems with security in the past that forced him to seek refuge in neighboring South Africa. He has come back. He's been given the mandate. Is he going to carry out his security sector reforms that he promised following this meeting?
He regards the reforms as imminent as ever, because he's of the ideal of actually reforming the entire army and the security sector as a whole. He's still in negotiation with our regional body, SADC, with respect to trying to help Lesotho to stabilize, especially in the security sector. And as I can tell you, you know, he's challenged as a prime minister, a sitting prime minister now, to actually implement SADC decisions. And on those decisions, there are some factors which he has to face in the army.
So when they met, how did the meeting go? How would you classify the meeting?
No, it was a good meeting, which is giving the shape of actually people intending to reconcile and take the country forward.
I know supporters of the All Basotho Congress have said that they will protect the Prime Minister with sticks if need be. What message are you passing to them?
No, right now, I'm saying they should leave the leadership take the lead and they will report.
Samonyane Ntsekele is the General Secretary of the All Basotho Convention, or ABC, in the Kingdom of Lesotho. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru. The Tanzanian President John Magufuli has seen his popularity take a hit following a recent poll conducted by Twaweza, nicknamed Tinga Tinga or the Bulldozer. Magufuli came to power promising to weed out corruption and to improve the living conditions of Tanzanians. But the latest poll shows his approval rating has dropped by 25% from a high of 96 to the current 71%. According to Twaweza, the opposition has yet to take advantage of the drop in the president's approval rating. Aiden Eyakuze, the executive director of Twaweza, told me the sharp drop in approval ratings for all politicians sends a sobering message that Tanzanians are fast losing trust in their political leaders.
Briefly, we conducted a poll, which we do every 6 to 8 weeks across the country. And this time around, we were asking about approval rating of the various leaders at various levels of government, and also their priorities in terms of the issues that they think are the most pressing problems for the country. And finally, to get a sense from them of their party affiliations. So the main finding, if I was to begin with priorities, is that the sense of food insecurity and the difficult economic conditions seem to be the number one priority for the Tanzanians. The surprising one was a reduction in corruption as a top priority. It used to feature amongst the top four for quite a while.
When it came to the politicians, specifically, what were some of the findings you came up with?
The president clearly is the one that caught everybody's attention. The approval rating of the president went from 96% the last time we conducted the poll about 10 months ago, down to 71% when we did this poll this time around. We asked conducted our poll actually in April, and we launched the report 2 days ago. So that's the big sort of headline finding in terms of the approval rating for President John Magufuli. That trend, although the percentage point drop seems significant, the trend is mirrored in terms of the approval rating of MPs, of local councillors, and of local the chairman of the villages and local neighbourhoods that we elect here. So there's a general decline in trust and approval rating of politicians in Tanzania. That's the thing that we found in this poll.
What would you say contributed to the decline of 25% of the popularity or approval rating of the president? Because he has been very popular. They nicknamed him Tinga Tinga.
That's true. I think two things, if I was to summarize them into two words. One is expectations and the other is austerity. When he came to power, the expectations, as with previous presidents, I recall President Kikwete when in his early days in power, President Mkapa in his early days in power, expectations of Tanzanian voters were very, very, very high. But since he has been in power, he has done a number of policy actions. He has done a number of real administrative actions of trying to get rid of wasteful spending, incompetence in government, and this kind of thing. Which has earned him a lot of respect and kudos. On the other side, there has been a sense from many Tanzanians that we are in a period of pretty significant economic austerity, and it is biting people's pockets. So that's one in general. But the second, which is no fault of the president or any political leader, is the fact that we had a pretty dismal harvest season in 2016. Rains weren't very good, so the harvest was not very good. Food stocks ran very low and ran out by the end of 2016. But I think the people felt that the response of the government to this food insecurity did not reflect an empathetic position. And so they felt, I think, a sense a little bit left out in the cold or left on their own, despite the fact that the government did announce that they were going to distribute food to about, I think, of the most seriously affected districts.
Despite all these concerns that Tanzanians expressed, it appears that from your findings that the main opposition party still isn't as popular or not gaining traction on Chama Chama Pinduzi or the CCM ruling party. What accounted for this from your findings?
We saw again a secular reduction in the approval ratings for the main opposition party in Chama. The other parties held their own at 1%, 1%, 1%. This is NCCR Mageuzi, CUF, and the ACT Wazalendo. But for Chadema, I think I would hazard a guess. I would attribute this to more internal strife within Chadema, within the leadership, and perhaps a sense expressed in the reduction in their popularity that the citizens were not quite sure of the leadership and maybe even the democratic credentials of a party called Chama cha Demokrasia na Maendeleo. I think the citizens are saying that maybe this is not really at the moment in its current shape and form a credible alternative to CCM.
Aidan Eyakuzi is the executive director of the Tanzanian poll company Twaweza. He spoke with me from the commercial capital Dar es Salaam. The Zambian main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND, says the party plans to legally challenge parliament's decision to suspend 48 of its legislators. Charles Kakoma, spokesman for the UPND, says the suspension is a flagrant violation of the constitutional rights of the lawmakers. Parliament suspended 48 legislators from the opposition after they walked out in protest against President Edgar Lungu's speech in parliament. The UPND does not recognize the president as winner of the last election. Kakoma told me that the UPND is prepared to push back on what he says is the decision by the government to use state institutions to intimidate and harass opponents.
We are contemplating taking the matter to court so that those MPs bounce back in parliament. The decision was excessive, and we think that it was politically motivated. Not the first time that members of parliament have walked out of the house. Not the first time that members of parliament have exercised their constitutional rights. In the constitution, the members of parliament are entitled to freedoms and rights of speech and expression. And to express yourself, you can either decide to keep quiet or to speak or not to attend an event or function or indeed to boycott. And boycotting is an expression, so you cannot be punished for expressing and enjoying your constitutional rights.
Is the UPND thinking about launching a legal challenge to this, since the party says this is a flagrant violation of the constitutional right of the UPND lawmakers in parliament?
Correct. There will be a legal challenge. But also politically, pressure is mounting on the ruling party that the suspension of these members of parliament is part of the scheme to introduce one-party dictatorship in Zambia. Because in the absence of the UPND members of parliament, it has basically left the house with only the Patriotic Front members of parliament, and they will be passing laws as members belonging to one political party. There will no longer be laws that are passed by parliament, but passed by the Patriotic Front, and that is pure one-party state.
Some people are saying, why wouldn't the lawmakers continue to maintain a stance as the opposition party while you wait for the court to address your concerns of the legitimacy of President Edgar Lungu? Why institute such measures that some are saying is a shot in the UPND's foot by its own hands?
Well, political pressure is being applied in many forms. And our members of parliament will use any opportunity to apply that pressure. And what is eating the ruling party is that they feel inadequate, they feel illegitimate because we have not recognized them. So recognition has become an issue. And if they can feel the pressure of recognition, we'll continue to hammer along those lines so that the illegitimacy is felt by them.
Some are saying that the international community recognizes Edgar Lungu as the legitimate president of Zambia. Lots of heads of state have come to confer with him, and they are saying this shows that the UPND tactics appear not to be working, including an alliance of yours calling for a boycott by the international community, and they said these are not working.
Well, they can have heads of state visiting them. That does not change the situation on the ground. The people still feel that, and UPND still feel that Edgar Lungu did not win the election. It doesn't change anything, even if he is visited by many heads of state, because the challenge in the court is still there, that the election petition should be heard. Why is the ruling party scared of having election petition to be heard? So that will not change things on the ground. The Zambian people feel that there is something terribly wrong in what is happening in our country, and they feel that Edgar Lungu and the ruling party are on the wrong side of the equation.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesman for the Zambian Main Opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Kenya says it has taken a number of measures to address a severe drought and a serious food shortage affecting millions of people across the country. This as aid agencies continue to warn of a worsening situation in the Horn of Africa region. For VOA, Ruben Chiama reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
The Kenya Red Cross says up to 2.7 million Kenyans face starvation. In response, President Uhuru Kenyatta has declared the drought a national disaster. Government spokesman Eric Kiraithe says authorities have devoted millions of dollars aimed at tackling hunger.
In spite of the drought, in spite of the shortages, the government has worked with other hard-working Kenyans, farmers, traders, to ensure that the country is food secure and to continue being food secure. For the low-income earners, who are not traditionally recipients of food relief, we know the price and the cost has been biting. The measures which have been put in place have made the food available.
Those measures include subsidies on maize flour and the importation of 13,000 tons of the commodity from neighboring Ethiopia. According to the United Nations Humanitarian Agency, OCHA, some 26.7 million people across the Horn of African countries, including Kenya, Ethiopia, Somalia, and South Sudan, are experiencing severe drought and food shortages. Kiraithe says the severe weather has driven up the cost of food and fueled inflation across the region.
For the last 3 years, East Africa, South Africa, and the region have been experiencing a drought which has been rated the worst in 20 years. For example, all the measures in place now project that those parts of the country which have a mini harvest in August might not be able to have the kind of harvest they have traditionally enjoyed.
The hunger crisis has been exacerbated by the impact of climate change. Kiraithe says the government is actively involved in engaging smallholder farmers to come up with sustainable solutions.
Sensitization on the need to be part of managing the environment, choosing drought-resistant crops for food security, to ensure that the current obsession with maize, which is a very demanding crop, as opposed to something like cassava, which is actually nutritionally much more richer, and other traditional crops, which would do wonders with the current advancement in crop husbandry. The issue of now converting land previously utilized for other purposes like Igalana, Kulalu, to food production, because the issue of population increase is also there.
The Igalana Kulalu Food Security Project is an innovative irrigation effort on the Kenyan coast that's spearheaded by the government. The 400,000-acre project adjacent to the Galana River is aimed at transforming agricultural production in the country through large-scale irrigation systems, particularly for maize. Food scientists attribute fluctuating and often extreme weather patterns to climate change. In response, Many urge national government to support the Paris Climate Accord, which encourages government to set goals for reducing carbon and other pollutants into the atmosphere. Kenya has released a plan called the Nationally Determined Contribution that would reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 30% over the next 13 years. It would also encourage agriculture and other sectors to adapt to climate change with improved technologies. Already, Kenya is investing in clean power with the Lake Turkana Wind Power Plant, the Garissa Solar Power Plant, and a geothermal plant in Olkaria. In contrast, the US government recently announced it would leave the Paris Climate Change Accord. Kiraitha says it's a move that his government respects, though Nairobi is following another approach.
What do we think about American pullout? We respect America as a sovereign state, but as a government, we actually think that environmental changes is a global issue. We would be better working on this together, the priority for our national interests notwithstanding.
He says the American authorities, like those in any democracy, are responding to climate change with policies that are supported by voters. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Researchers have identified a weakness in the malaria parasite that could halt mosquito-borne infection in its tracks, not only offering the possibility of a cure, but a way to interrupt transmission. VOA's Jessica Berman reports from Washington.
It's being called the malaria parasite's Achilles heel, a protein that the parasite, Plasmodium falciparum, uses to infect red blood cells. By blocking the protein called PFAP2I, the malaria parasite cannot enter the cells, where it replicates billions of times before bursting forth into the bloodstream. The hallmark symptoms of malaria, including high fever and chills, come in waves every 48 hours, each time the parasite reproduces, halting the so-called invasion phase. According to lead researcher Manuel Yinas, could potentially stop the infection, offering a cure.
Invasion has been, for a long time, considered, you know, one of the key parasite-specific processes that, if inhibited, would then prevent the full-blown massive infections that one normally gets.
Yinas and colleagues at Pennsylvania State University have identified and characterized PFAP2I, finding that it regulates more than 150 parasitic genes, nearly 20% of which are known to be involved in red cell invasion. The findings are reported in the journal Cell Host and Microbe. For the past 50 years, Yinas says researchers have been trying to find a way to attack the invasion phase, typically with vaccines that harness the immune system. Because the parasite has dozens of mechanisms that pull it into red blood cells after attaching to their surface, Yinas says it's hard to raise an immune response to block them all. Yinas says a compound that interferes with the parasite's PFAP2I protein has the potential to stop invasion in a single action.
You will ultimately impact a very large number of genes that are involved in invasion, but you only need to target one protein specifically, and that's the AP2I protein, because if it doesn't function properly, it's never turning on this large set of invasion genes that are required for that process to actually ever occur.
Yinas says the next step is to actually develop a drug that targets the parasitic protein. In addition to a possible cure, an agent that blocks PFAP2I has the potential to break the transmission cycle, since there would be few, if any, daughter parasites in the bloodstream to infect biting mosquitoes. There are an estimated 212 million cases of malaria each year, and the disease kills 429,000 people, most of them young children, in sub-Saharan Africa. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter. Good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with football. African Confederation Cup matches resume this week. In Group A, on June 20th, Rivers United of Nigeria host KCCA of Uganda. And on 21st June, Club Africain of Tunisia host FUS Rabat of Morocco. In Group B, Sfaxien of Tunisia will play away to Platinum Stars of South Africa. MC Algo of Algeria will host Platinum Stars. In Group C, CRD Libolo of Angola will host Zesco of Zambia, while Smoha of Egypt will play away to Hilal El Obeid Club of Sudan. And in Group D, Supersport United of South Africa will host Mazembe of DR Congo, while Horoya of Guinea will host Monana of Gabon. Moving on from football to athletics, Olympic champion Conseslus Kipruto will headline the 3,000-meter steeplechase at Golden Spike in Ostrava, Czech Republic, on June 28th. Organizers of the IAAF World Challenge meeting have confirmed. The men's event was last staged in Ostrava in 2013, when Kipruto, then a rising star in the event and still just 18, took a comfortable victory less than 2 months before racing to silver at the World Championships in Moscow. This year, the Kenyan returns as the reigning Olympic champion, one of seven already confirmed for the event. Rio winners Mo Farah, Wide Van Niekerk, David Rudisha, Christian Taylor, and Anita Waldazarski have already been announced, along with German's Thomas Reuler, who will headline a unique German versus Czech Republic match in the men's javelin. Finally, in boxing, Australian middleweight star David Tusa, with a record of an unbeaten 10 fights, will return to ring action on July 2nd against Class A American Shane Mosley Jr., with a record of 10 wins and 1 loss, at the Suncorp Stadium, Brisbane, Queensland, Australia, on the undercard of the WBO welterweight title bout featuring champion Manny Pacquiao and WBO number 2 challenger Jeff Horn. Mosley is the son of boxing great Shane Mosley Sr. Mosley Jr. is coming off a knockout victory over Demetrius Walker in March. Tusa is coming off a stoppage victory over Junior Talipu in 2016. Pacquiao returned to boxing last November after a short-lived retirement by unseating then WBO champion Jesse Vargas over 12 dominant rounds. Horn, 9 years Pacquiao's junior at 29, was a decent amateur but lacks a standout win as a professional, making him a significant underdog against Manny. Meanwhile, Pacquiao's WBO welterweight title defense against Jeff Horn on July 2nd has officially become the biggest fight in Australia's history after selling over 40,000 tickets. Ticket sales have surpassed the 38,000 record set by Azuma Nelson's win over Jeff Fennec in Melbourne in 1992. According to Queensland's Minister of Tourism and Major Events, Kate Jones, with 40,000 tickets already sold, it will be the biggest boxing crowd ever seen in Australia. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. Lady, baby, oh, I love you, baby.
na tabia za kupendeza roho. Tabasamu ya kupapasa macho. Sauti yako nikisikia pia natulia, yani punguzi ya hasira nazo. Urembo wako lini nasa roho. Siku ya kwanza kukuona kwa macho. Sa moyoni umekwamia, siwezi kutania, njo unipunguzie mawazo. And I feel you in my air when I breathe. I see you in my dreams when I sleep. You're the one I've been waiting for all my life. But deep down in my heart I believe. Unani feel na kufeel in it real. The one I've been waiting for all my life. Kukusawana, wote malaika na mabawa yao. Wote wana kwega wendo mama yao. Niwewe na chagua sisemi now. Sisemi, oh baby kukusawana. Wote malaika na mabawa yao. Wote wana kwega wendo mama yao. Niwewe na chagua sisemi. Oh, sisemi, oh, sisemi. This is how it feels to fall in love. Baby, you know I love you. I place no one above you. I need you in my life forever and ever. You will always have my heart. We're meant to be together, me and you. Hold me and you.
What is love?
You cannot hear no more.
What is love?
You cannot hear no more.
What is love?
You cannot hear no more.
mukatale okusiteje yo mukatale siyande kamu maziga yangula binyebwe li mukatale engoye sena koyola wenali mutegeka gende ko muchibuga mifano je yasibula era yabasubiza likoma wali bachima binyewa binali ngula bali byakutereka mekete ko muchibuga Chibuga, oba ya walira ya sigala, na basanja womu chibuke yo. My baby, listen to my story, my little love story. If you hear it, I mean it. If you hear it on the radio, my little love story, baby, I mean it. Aliena na basi, na basi, na basi. Aliena na basi, aliena na basi. Now I'm single and searching for my special perfect fitting. Honey, if you're hearing, welcome home and rock it with me. My baby, listen to my story, my little love story. If you hear it, I mean it. If you hear it on the radio, my little love story, baby, I mean it. Aliena na basi, na basi, na basi. Nasikire bizimbe bya tata Yona yona jencha kalira Bantenda nti musajja wakabaka Sina yena munda bila kamugambe Nasikire bizimbe bya tata Ele yona jencha kalira Bantenda nti musajja wakabaka Wade ya genda mabasi Wanjagala wakashi Mpoza somu katalenze Soloze binye babamba bya mumalebe Aliena na basi, na basi, na basi. Aliena na basi, na basi, na basi. Ziyande kamu katale, kusiteje yo mukatale. Ziyande kamu maziga, yangula binyewe li mukatale.
Sita simama mama obu ya kitawala
sitasimama maovu ya kitawala. Ufisadi ubinafsi ukabila, kuuza sura watakikuuza sera. Ndugu nikupana, sitasimama maovu ya kitawala. Sitasimama maovu ya kitawala.
Women watching Swans Avenue. I want you more and more. My heart a flow like a waterfall. Fight for you like Tom God. In the matter who me, I pick them all. Yeah. Show me, don't you got a spy. Show me, don't you got a spy. Munda yenge. Today you say yes, tomorrow you tell me no. You give me a smiley face, but when you go, you turn and go. You love me in my dress, tomorrow it's too short. Boy, what you want, what you don't want, is a simani, and no me na na. What you want, what you don't want, is a simani, and no me na na. What's that I want, say the yarn, and they call me up for love, boy. What's that I will say to you, don't call me up for love. Show me, don't you kind of spy. Show me, don't you kind of spy. Wonder yonder, your name. Man for a woman, then on the way if you take my hand. Every dog gets done, it all ends there, you feel by my plan. Want to know the apple of a tree, tell me what you see. Bump him up, him on Zencology, I tell you what I feel. Me and you, birds of a feather. Yeah, become a good trucker. Me and you, fell well together. What's that I want, say the yard, and they call me a fellow. What's that I want, say the yard, and they call me a fellow. Show me, don't you kind of spy. Show me, don't you kind of spy.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Few months ago, when President Salva Kiir initiated the National Dialogue for Reconciliation, he called on all the people of South Sudan to forgive him for whatever wrong he may have done to them. However, he did not say whether he himself was prepared to forgive any other South Sudanese who may have done something to offend him. Over the months and years since the civil conflict began in 2013, we have seen that the conflict had intensified and spread throughout South Sudan. Dr. Riek Machar, who was a major protagonist for the president, has been isolated, some say, in house arrest or hotel arrest in South Africa. The illusion that you could bring peace to South Sudan by isolating Riek Machar have been proven to be a really foolish one. And yet, nothing has been done significantly to bring Dr. Riek Machar once more into the dialogue. And strange enough, last week, President Salva Kiir removed all ambiguity by declaring that Dr. Riek Machar should not be part of the national dialogue. They have moved away from the precondition that for him to be involved in the affairs of South Sudan, he must first declare non-violence in the solution of the problem. The sub-regional group was correct in asking all South Sudanese to meet and solve their problem. IGAD did what was right, and it is foolish that President Salva Kiir has now removed all doubt that he wants to solve the problem without dealing with the underlying issues which gave rise to the civil conflict in the first place. Anyone who has followed this dispute in South Sudan knows that the real problem is the idea that a small group or an ethnic group can prevail in South Sudan against the interests of other ethnic groups. This is not going to work. There was a time even when those who were supposed to assist in the negotiations felt that Dr. Riek Machar was the main problem and should be set aside. This now is not going to work. So there has to be a renewed pressure on the government of South Sudan to deal with the reality and to bring Dr. Riek Machar into the dialogue. Now, we know why they are trying to avoid this issue of Dr. Riek Machar. The civil conflict in South Sudan, first against the government of the Sudan, showed that the people who have been in the thick and thin include Dr. Riek Machar. And I would say another man was Dr. Garang. And it is time for not only IGAD, but the African Union and the United Nations to insist that President Salva Kiir remove all the pressure he's applying and sit down across the table with Riek Machar to solve the problems. Because we know who are the victims. The victims are the innocent people of South Sudan who had left the country in droves and now in refugee camps. We have heard the cries of the women who have been suffering in this conflict and also who have called on the government that they should be serious to solve the problem of South Sudan. Now, any attempt that has been made to solve this problem has been rejected by the government. The United Nations Security Council trying to bring in a protection force to assure all of those who may want to have the national dialogue. And the government still believes that it alone can solve the problem. The time has come for greater pressure to be applied against the President Salva Kiir and his strong supporters who are not caring for the innocent people of South Sudan. This is the only way that the problem will be solved. Blaming the government of Sudan for assisting the rebel forces is not going to solve the problem. So this is the time for greater pressure on the government of South Sudan to meet and bring into the dialogue Dr. Riek Machar, and he should be released for wherever he is confined at the present time. Because after 4 years of civil conflict, the time is indeed opportune for a national dialogue that embraces all the parties concerned in South Sudan. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Bill Barber, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a black cow also gives white milk. I'm your host, Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa. Thank you.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In congressional testimony, U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis said North Korea's advancing missile and nuclear programs were the most urgent and dangerous threat to peace and security. Moreover, North Korea's continued pursuit of nuclear weapons and the means to deliver them has increased in pace and scope. This statement comes on the heels of yet another series of missile launches by the authoritarian regime of Kim Jong-un. Last week, North Korea fired what appeared to be several land-to-ship missiles off its east coast, according to South Korea's military. It is the latest in a fast-paced series of missile tests, defying world pressure to rein in its weapons program. In his June 12th written statement to the House Armed Services Committee, Secretary Mattis said the North Korean regime's nuclear weapons program is a clear and present danger to all, and the regime's provocative actions, manifestly illegal under international law, have not abated despite United Nations censure and sanctions. Earlier this month, the UN Security Council expanded targeted sanctions against North Korea after its repeated missile tests, adopting the first such resolution agreed to by both the United States and China since President Donald Trump took office. The U.S. is determined to meet the threat posed by North Korea and to defend its allies in the region. As Secretary Mattis made clear in Singapore, our commitment to the defense of the Republic of Korea and Japan, to include the employment of our most advanced capabilities, is ironclad. Moreover, in response to the vow by Pyongyang to develop a nuclear-tipped intercontinental ballistic missile, the U.S. will take further steps to protect the homeland, as demonstrated by the recent successful ballistic missile defense test. As Secretary Mattis has said, any attack on the United States or on our allies will be defeated, and any use of nuclear weapons would be met with the response that would be effective and overwhelming.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.